Good afternoon. You are tuned in to Juno Afternoon here for Wednesday, the 13th of January, 2016. Jeff Fowler here today. We'll get an update on EcoFest activities with Lindsay Halvick and Jeffra Clow. We'll talk with Kathy Stepien and Carrie Natwick about eating disorders and how families can access treatment here in Juno. We'll find out about America's Salmon Fest and their Thursday night party. We'll continue the bike adventure series that Eric Olson talking about his ride through the Alps of France. And I'll talk with Blake Ryder about the upcoming DO service. That Writer's Almanac, Bruno at Musical More today on a Juno afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, rain showers with the low temperatures around 35 degrees. Forecast for Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies. Friday, partly cloudy skies in the morning, then becoming sunny.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Hundreds of people attended a rally at the Wisconsin State Capitol Tuesday to voice their opposition of a bill that would allow for excavations of ancient mounds. Parth Shah reports.
People from all 11 of the state's Indian nations gathered at the Capitol to speak out against the Wisconsin Landowner Rights Act.
This is not about landowners' rights.
John Greendeer is former president of the Ho-Chunk Nation.
This is not about correcting the burial site preservation law. This is about money.
The Republican-backed bill would allow property owners to excavate burial mounds on their land to check for bones. If no human remains are found, the property owner would be able to use that land freely. Bob Shea owns a quarry in Dane County that contains a burial mound.
There's a lot of rock there that could be accessed should there not be remains. It is highly marketable.
Andy Bovian is a member of the Menominee Nation. He traveled from northern Wisconsin to protest the bill.
How would you like it if this bill gets passed and next thing you know, they want to dig up your ancestors and build on it?
Wisconsin State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says after speaking to members of the state's Indian tribes, the bill will not be voted on this spring. Ho-Chunk Nation Tribal Chief Clayton Winishek sees that as a small victory.
It's going to be brought back in a different manner. So what we as Ho-Chunks and all the other tribes in Wisconsin, we're going to try to take a stance on that and be ready for the next step that these representatives are going to try to take to reestablish this bill.
Wisconsin was once home to more than 20,000 mounds. There are between 2,000 and 4,000 left today. For National Native News, I'm Parth Shah.
A Native American college student was invited to President Obama's State of the Union address Tuesday to highlight the high cost of student debt. Matt Laszlo has a story from Washington.
Carrie Albahi is a member of the Navajo Nation. She interned for New Mexico Democratic Senator Martin Heinrich, but she never expected he'd invite her to attend the State of the Union address.
It's very exciting, and I'm very, very, very thankful for him to invite me here.
Bahi was asked to attend the address because, like many college students across the nation, she's trying to get a college degree without getting saddled with debt. She says it's hard, but she keeps plugging away at her secondary education degree at the University of New Mexico anyway, all while trying to avoid all the debt.
My parents, like, talk about it a lot, and they just, like, don't want me to do that. So mostly I'm just work, trying to get find jobs and stuff to support and finish my college education at UNM.
Senator Heinrich says she highlights the plight of many.
But that's a huge set of decisions that every college student wrestles with now because so many of our students end up graduating with substantial debt right out of their senior year.
President Obama used his final State of the Union address to call for making college affordable for every American. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Following Obama's State of the Union address, in the coming days, his cabinet members will travel the country to highlight issues, including climate change and health care. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell will travel to Indian Country with stops in Arizona and New Mexico to discuss education and land restoration. On Thursday, the president of the National Congress of American Indians will lay out priorities for the year. President Brian Clatesby will deliver the 2016 State of Indian Nations Address from Washington, D.C. The speech is scheduled annually following the State of the Union. Tribal leaders across the country are focusing on a number of policy issues, from language and culture to economic development and natural resources management. In the last few years, much attention has been placed on providing opportunities for young Native people. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the National Indian Health Board. Open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace ends January 31st. Many Indian health clinics are hosting enrollment events with help available. You may qualify for low-cost plans, zero copays, and deductibles. More info at healthcare.gov/tribal. Kawanak Broadcast Corporation is accepting artwork and reservations for the Alaska Native Art Auction February 18, 2016 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event. Proceeds benefit Kawanak's news program. Learn more at knba.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juneau Afternoon. First volunteers for today are Jeffrey Clow and Lindsay Hellenbeck, here to talk about the Learn to Adapt and Eagle Quest in general. Thank you so much for coming down to the station.
Thanks for having us this afternoon, Jeff.
Thanks.
So let's talk first about the Learn to Adapt program. Can you explain it briefly, Lindsay?
Yeah, so this Sunday, January 17th, from 10 to 2 at Eagle Crest, we're doing our annual Learn to Adapt Disability Awareness Day. And so what it is we have all the adaptive equipment out ready to be used, and people, regardless of their ability, whether you are fully able-bodied or you have a disability, you can come up, try the equipment for free.
What does the equipment look like?
Oh, we have a lot of things. We have some sit skis that you can go downhill skiing in. We have sit skis you can try out for Nordic skiing. Then we also have outriggers that can help somebody with balance or somebody that might be missing a limb. And then we also have, you know, instructors that are able to, you know, help navigate how to use the equipment, and also just, I don't know, to help people get out on the slopes, however it may be.
It must be a special feeling helping somebody ski who's never skied before, or does it so rarely, it's a new experience each time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, everybody comes kind of with their own story and their own needs, and so we kind of just meet people where they're at and figure out what piece of equipment is best for them and get them out.
About how many volunteers do you have?
Right now we have about 25 volunteers, but actually this Saturday we're having our last volunteer training at the mountain too, so if that's something that people are still wanting to get involved in, we're having our final one, and we can always use more volunteers to help assist people on the mountain.
And, Jeffrey, what's going on otherwise with Eagle Crest?
Well, it's, you know, we're in the middle of January, and January is Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month, and our Learn to Adapt Day is one of our main features, a great event on the mountain just to make an awareness and get everybody everyone, regardless of their ability, can have a great time up on the mountain. But this is also the 34th annual Learn to Ski Weekend this weekend that's sponsored by Mendenhall Auto Subaru. And we picked the 40 lucky kids today, and they're posted on our website at skijuneau.com. And they'll receive a phone call tomorrow and an invite to come to the orientation on Friday night. And then they'll be treated to a weekend of skiing.
That's a great deal. And Mendenhall Auto supports it.
Mendenhall Auto Subaru has been a longtime sponsor, and we certainly could not do this event without them. So we thank them so much for their ongoing sponsorship. And other than that, it's just there's some great skiing and snowboarding up on the mountain. If you've not learned how to ski or snowboard yet this winter, you know, we've got some great classes and programs up there to get on up there. If you want to find a little bit more about adaptive skiing or snowboarding or Nordic skiing, come up on Sunday and, you know, Eagle Crest is there, and you can find all the information at skijuneau.com or find us on your favorite social media.
So, an update on what happened last Friday.
Last Friday, it was a fabulous event, Jeff. We had 87 people come up and learn how to ski and snowboard. They're also included one mono skier out of that. I think it was 33 snowboarders, and I can't do the math correctly, but I think it was about over 40 skiers, and they all ages, from ages 3 on up to 60. We had 18 instructors up there, and everyone had a great time. Many folks stayed on all day long and skied and snowboarded, and we've seen many of them back this past weekend and have reservations on the books for them to come back this coming weekend. So it was a great event, and we were happy to be part of trying to set the Guinness World Book of Records.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming down, Lindsay and Jeff. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, just it's winter. Come on up and enjoy the winter at Eagle Crest and come to SkiJuno.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 13th of January, 2016. It's the birthday of Laurie Moore, born in Glens Falls, New York, 1957, author of short story collections Like Life, Birds of America. Skipped a grade in school when she was growing up, and the difference in age made her feel small and shy. She said, "I felt so completely thin that I was afraid to walk over grates. I thought I would fall down and disappear." Started writing in college, published her first story in 17 magazine, and then discovered that her mother and father had wanted to be writers as well. Her father had kept up in the attic stories that he'd once sent off to the New Yorker, and her mother admitted that she'd given up journalism for nursing. Laurie Moore, in grad school, had to decide whether she wanted to write or devote herself to the piano. She said, "I was completely unaccomplished musically, but I was having ecstatic experiences in the practice room, so I had to choose." She chose writing, came out with her first book of short stories when she was 26 years old. Her first book, entitled Self-Help, stories written in the style of how-to manuals, including How to Be a Writer, which begins, "First, try to be something, anything else, a movie star astronaut, a movie star missionary, a movie star kindergarten teacher, president of the world. Fail miserably. It is best if you fail at an early age, say 14. Her most recent book, a collection of stories called Bark. It came out in 2014. And it's the birthday of the novelist Jay McInerney, born in Hartford, 1955. Father was a sales executive. Family moved around the world. The boy went to 18 different elementary schools. Wound up in New York City, lived the high life, fashion parties and dance clubs, and then wrote about it in his first novel, Bright Lights, Big City. Came out in 1983. In order to write about it, he had to leave New York City and move to Syracuse. Jay McInerney's most recent book is The Juice, Venus Veritas, collection of essays about wine. Here's a poem for today by David Ray entitled Poe's Anvil. At the drive-in theater where they sell junk on Sundays, we saw a man and his wife standing by a pickup truck trying to sell his anvil. It sat up in the truck's bed. It was black, heavy, and elegant, like a mammoth's tusk, and his name was written on it, like a signature in iron that once ran like ink. His name was Poe. I talked with him, and he recalled briefly days when his anvil stood outside a shed, a workshop like a harbor set in a sea of green tomato fields, and inside he had a coal fire and a bellows, and he watched the tractor replace mules and the car replace wagons. He tired of horseshoes, wagon wheels, and plows, of hitches, harrows, and lugs, of axles, crankcases, and flywheels, and he sat somewhat amused and dying, his wife told us, presiding over the sale of his own monument, which he wanted someone to go on hammering on. And in the midday city sun, the theater's white screen was blank, like a faded quilt or Moby Dick's stretched skin. Poe's Anvil, poem by David Ray, from Music of Time, selected in New Poems, published by the Backwater Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices. Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games. Lumosity.com. engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Program support from Goldtown Theater, presenting the Telluride Mountain Film Festival, showcasing nonfiction short films about environmental, cultural, political, and social justice issues. Playing January 16th through 19th. Details at goldtownnick.com.
It's about 15 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to it Juno Afternoon, here for Wednesday, the 13th of January. Our next guests in the studio are Kathy Steppen and Carrie Natwick, here to talk about eating disorders. Thank you for coming down to the station.
Thanks for having us.
So, you're a dietitian.
I am.
And, Kathy, you are a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what you're talking about, much more than me, so I'm going to let you answer all the questions today. Eating disorders, what are they?
I think of an eating disorder as an unhealthy relationship with food that has consequences to a person's life and their well-being.
Could you be more specific?
Sure. Well, in medical terms, we have very strict criteria about how do we diagnose an eating disorder. And there's very specific things we look for. Is A, B, and C present, for example? And if all the criteria are met, then we check the box and say, oh, this person has an eating disorder. I think more broadly, though, we can step back and say only about 50% of people who have problems with food and unhealthy behaviors fall into our very strict criteria. And so at that point, we kind of step back and say there's an eating disorder, but we're not going to define it as anorexia or bulimia or binge eating, for example.
How common is it?
It's very common. It's 0.5 to 1% of people teens across the country have anorexia. Bulimia is even higher. I believe it might be 5%. But I think some element of disordered eating is much, much more common than we generally recognize.
Is it age specific?
Well, I would dare say that eating disorders really don't discriminate. When we talk about, you know, do they affect certain ages? They're definitely, we can definitely say that there's a higher prevalence among adolescent girls, you know, teenage girls. But there's statistics that show that even girls as young as 8, you know, if they're shown even images of women and their bodies, that they start to develop disordered eating patterns or poor body image as young as 8, you know. And, you know, I've even heard of statistics of, you know, young kids, even as young as 5, you know, having a disordered body image because of, you know, various reasons, because of exposure to, you know, who knows what, media or something, you know, conversations that take place in the household. But, you know, they can affect anybody at any age, and it can be a male, it can be a female, and it really doesn't matter what your ethnicity is either.
Would you call them psychological or physiological?
So, you know, eating disorders are technically a psychological disorder, but they have many, you know, ramifications, both medical ramifications and psychological, and lots of ramifications, I mean, just in the way that people, their relationship to their bodies and to food. So there's that psychological component of it all. And so, you know, really the root of an eating disorder is that intense desire to control the food that you eat or control the amount of physical activity that you engage in so that you can obtain or maintain a certain body weight. That really is kind of what the root of eating disorders are, is they're really about, trying to obtain a certain type of physique or a certain body weight.
So you diagnose it by interviews?
Interviews. Interviews, yeah, definitely. So there's definitely, you know, and Kathy can talk about this more, there's a lot of criteria that we use to diagnose eating disorders. And so, you know, first of all, you know, definitely, you know, doing a medical assessment, and I'll let Kathy talk about the criteria, you know, more the criteria that she looks at. And when I see somebody who has a suspected eating disorder, a lot of what I'm trying to evaluate is what their attitudes and beliefs are about food and about their bodies. And so, you know, what is, do they have certain fears of food. You know, often, you know, some of the signs of that I'll look for are things like restricting food. You know, that's always a big one. If a patient has certain types of foods that they don't eat, like they, for young girls especially, if they categorically remove foods from their diets like gluten, or they become a vegetarian overnight, or they stop eating fat, or they stop eating carbohydrates, you know, those can all be kind of big warning signs to parents or to loved ones, or, you know, to even to caregivers, that somebody may have kind of a, an abnormal relationship with food, and they may be restricting in order to achieve, again, to achieve that certain body weight, or to, you know, obtain a certain, you know, physique with their body. So I look at, you know, mostly that those attitudes and behaviors around food. Are there, you know, times where they're eating a significant amount of food, like as in a binge eating disorder, and they might be doing it in secret, and they might be feeling really guilty, or they might have a lot of shame associated with that event. And, of course, if there's any evidence of somebody purging, you know, trying to get rid of food, whether that's through vomiting or through laxatives, you know, those are all kind of those behaviors and then again, some of the attitudes. And then there's also a lot of physical criteria that we use. You know, if somebody, you know, weight loss can be one, even weight gain in the instance of a binge eating disorder, but there's also lots of physical signs and symptoms. And in my line of work, we call it nutrition-focused physical signs and symptoms. And so I'll look for things like, well, is your hair thinning? Is your hair dry? Do you have muscle loss? You know, do you have, you know, problems with your teeth or dentition? Do you have, you know, dental caries because of purging? You know, there's a whole array of just kind of physical signs and symptoms that I'm looking for. So, and Kathy can talk about some of the other medical ones, I'm sure.
Certainly when we interview children that we're concerned about, we get pieces of the story, and we also get pieces from family members sometimes, and we get pieces perhaps from a coach or a school nurse or a teacher or somebody's friend who has concerns. And so when we're interviewing teens and children that we're concerned about, we really are trying to put piece together that puzzle. So we look for what they might be sharing with us in their story, but then also we look and see from a physical standpoint, what's their blood pressure like? What's their skin like? What's their hair like? What are all of the, is there muscle wasting? Are they having really low energy? Are they not being able to perform at school as well because their brain's just not getting food? It's starving. So all the whole picture of putting it together, the story and what we see comes together for us to put together a diagnosis.
So how do you treat it?
I think that a multidisciplinary approach is really the most effective. Some teens and children are so ill that they have to be hospitalized for their medical safety so that we can intervene and save their lives. If that's the case, we usually don't keep them here in Juneau. They will go down to Seattle or out to Anchorage and get intensive care that they need until they're medically stable. Once a person is past that critical starvation state, for example, with anorexia, then they're in a position that the multidisciplinary care, I think, is more effective. And with that, there may be a primary care provider, usually a pediatrician, since we have more training in working with teens and children. Also, a dietitian will work with someone in counseling. And that person plays an incredibly important role, both for the patient and also for the family members. Sometimes we have a psychiatry get involved with the team when needed. We may have family meetings and get the whole, you know, siblings and parents or whoever might be in that household together. So really bringing everyone together on the same page, because it's not a problem that goes away quickly. It's something that is going to take time, that there's great prognosis for in the long term. But if we just try to treat without a multidisciplinary approach, we're not going to get there, and it's going to take even longer.
What resources are available here in Juneau?
You want to talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, I think that the best resources that we have are our pediatricians in town. You know, that's generally where, you know, where it starts for many people when, you know, when an eating disorder is suspected. But, you know, I think that this is, you know, one of the reasons we're talking about this today is to create this level of awareness because, you know, in terms of you know, identifying an eating disorder, which is where it starts, it takes all of us. You know, it takes coaches, it takes teachers, it takes family members, it takes, you know, peers to help identify eating disorders. And then from there, you know, knowing who, you know, taking that person, that individual to the right resources, which is, it generally starts with your pediatrician. If that individual is already in counseling or psychiatric care, then that can also be another great place. And then, you know, sometimes people come to my, you know, land at the dietitian's office first because they've been experiencing weight loss and, you know, and I might be the individual that identifies a concern about a disordered eating pattern or a behavior. But, you know, I think that, you know, again, the reason to raise awareness around this is because I think that parents are some of the greatest resources as well for their teenagers or for their children who are identified with eating disorders. They're a really integral part of the multidisciplinary team. You know, I think that those are really the primary resources that we have in this community.
How common are eating disorders, and are they more common in Alaska or Juneau versus somewhere else down south?
You know, I think it's really hard to say. You know, we really don't have that kind of data to, you know, there really hasn't been, you know, those types of studies that have been done in Alaska or in our communities, I think, to where we can really say what the statistics are. But I think we can say with certainty that this is a problem in our community and that, you know, there are many individuals in our community who have eating disorders and there's many who haven't been identified.
I know there's a support group that I see listed in the newspaper. Do you know much about that support group?
We don't, no.
What about people who, given that this seems to be primarily a psychological problem, people just waiting it out?
That's probably not the best strategy, just to wait it out, because there are short-term and long-term health risks in doing so. A small percentage of people die from their eating disorders. If, let's say they don't die, let's say they may live but be less healthy, so less performing less well as a teenager in school, for example, or making plans for the future, not succeeding in relationships and kind of the normal developmental stages we'd expect because so much of time and energy is focused on food and eating or not eating that food. The other problems, of course, you'd run into, we know that it affects brain development and that there's even research that shows us that there's long-term insult, stuff that is permanent, that we carry into adulthood if there's a child or a teen with an eating disorder. And there's certainly long-term damage to other systems. There's problems with our heart or bones, for example, that are permanent. And so just writing it out is a risky idea.
And I think, you know, what I would say about that is that a lot of people think that it's just like in the case of anorexia nervosa that, you know, just eat the food, right? I've even heard people say that to individuals and loved ones with an eating disorder, but it's much, much more complex than that. And I think that it's so important to realize that really, you know, if you have an eating disorder, it's not just something you get over, so to speak. It's really something that requires an intervention, and it really does require that treatment from that multidisciplinary team.
I think the key with that, too, is that the eating disorder is not about the food.
Right.
We talk about the food and we focus on food, but the eating disorder itself is not about the food. And so we need to have that wraparound care addressing the bigger pictures.
So we've got people listening on the radio now, and some might be saying to themselves, these two women have got it. I got to talk to them. How did they find out more about this?
I'm at Rainforest Pediatric Care, which is the pediatric office right near the hospital. 463-1210 is our number.
And I'm at Bartlett, and my direct line is 796-8691.
I'm talking with Kathy Steppen, and Gary Natwick about eating disorders in Capital City. Anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All the nations like Bananda. All the races like Bananda. All the nations like Bananda. All the races like Bananda.
Mexico like it.
Banana.
Namibia like it.
Banana.
Russia like it.
Banana.
Middle East like it.
Banana.
Thailand like it.
Banana.
Uruguay like it.
Banana.
Italy like it.
Banana.
Australia like it.
Banana.
It's 31 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. Next guest in the studio is Rose from America's Salmon Forest. Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Yeah, of course.
Before we go too much further, can you please tell me what America's Salmon Forest is?
Yeah, so America's Salmon Forest is a coalition of sport, commercial, and subsistence fishermen, business owners and operators, as well as private citizens here in Southeast Alaska, working together to conserve high-quality salmon and trout habitats in the Tongass.
And you're having a party on Thursday.
We're having a party on Thursday, yep. So it's going to be in the Rockwell at in the back room behind the bar. We're going to have free beer and appetizers. We'll have free raffle prizes, and we'll be talking a little bit about the current comment period that's open right now for the land management plan for the Tongass.
Tell me more about the comment period, please.
Yeah, so the Forest Service is reviewing the management plan for the Tongass right now. The comment period will be open until about the third week of February, so we're really encouraging folks to submit comments to, encourage the Forest Service to make sure that there are increased conservation measures for over 70 of the most productive watersheds here in the Tongass for trout and salmon.
Is there a website that you have?
Yeah, our website is AmericanSalmonForest.org, and we have a Facebook page as well. That's America's Salmon Forest.
And the party at Thursday starts at what time?
7:30 on Thursday.
And it's free, and there's free beer.
Yep, it's free, so come on out.
Thanks for coming by. Anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
Nope, that's it. Thank you so much.
This is Bird Note. It's small consolation to those of us shoveling the stuff, but snow is a great insulator. Light, fluffy snow can be up to 90% trapped air. Just the thing to keep bears and ground squirrels and other hibernating mammals warm. And birds, too. Ptarmigan, those small Arctic grouse that molt into a white plumage each autumn, spend their long winter nights in cozy caves they excavate in snow. At dusk, they dig an entrance, then bulldoze their way beneath the surface to hollow out a well-insulated sleeping chamber. In truly harsh weather, they'll hunker down in their caves through the short Arctic day, too. Common redpolls move south to escape the Arctic winter. But even then, their wintering grounds in southern Canada and the northern U.S. can be snowy. These tiny, goldfinch-like birds with the bright red cap break through the snow with their heads, then burrow horizontally for up to a foot and a half. Come morning, when the sunshine warms the air, they pop out of the roosting cave, leaving the smooth blanket of snow pocked with redpole-sized craters. Something to look for next time you're out in your down parka with a thermos of hot chocolate. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
It's about 35 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm your host. Next guest in the studio is Eric Olson, who took part in a bike adventure going down to the Alps of France. Eric, thank you for coming by.
Thanks, Jeff.
You're having a workshop Is it tomorrow night or tonight?
It's tonight. It's tomorrow night. It's Thursday at 5:30, I think it is, at Cycle Alaska.
I got 5:15 on my list here.
5:15. I'll be there. I'll be there early.
Why'd you go?
Oh, it's just, if you like your bike, it's a fantastic way to travel. It's there's various ways to go. There's the way we went, which we'll talk about. Some people go and travel with a bike loaded with all their gear and camp out. Other people go to extremely expensive operators who fix you up at a chateau every night. And our group is various individuals come along. It's the center is Greg Cook, who's very fluent in French and has many, many connections over there. And we've traveled, various members of us have traveled, I don't know what this is now, 5-6 times. And he's been many more times. It's great fun. It's hard cycling, but then you eat and drink and have great company.
Just saying the Alps makes my legs hurt.
We went to a part of the Alps where at least I've never been before, east and south of Alpe d'Huez. People have heard of that maybe from the Tour de France. And then we went to another area to the west called the Vercors, which is less altitude. It's much quieter. Some days we'd hardly see a car or another bike, but gorgeous riding. Gorgeous country, fantastic riding, and then you can get good food anywhere in France. So you have to learn to take long lunches. That helps.
How did you outfit for the bicycles, not only for the ride, but just getting there?
In this case, everybody that came on this trip brought his own bike. And sometimes you can go with operators who will rent bikes for a week or whatever you want. And we all used more or less regular road bikes, not touring bikes that are with packs and racks to carry a lot of stuff, because our protocol has been that we rent a van and somebody has to drive it, but we don't hire anybody for that. We take turns driving. We spent 4 nights in one town and the 4 of us rode out every day from there, and then we drove with 4 of us for about a week we did that. Went near Alpe d'Huez, which people have heard of, the Galibier. People who follow this Tour de France, a small number of people may actually watch it live or recorded. In Juneau, we went up a number of the famous passes there. And then we got over to the Vercors region, where we stayed for, I think it's 8 or 9 days in one place, and rode each day. And a special treat was that there's a Frenchman who lives there, doesn't speak much English, but he's been to Juneau. He rode the Kluane bike relay race with us, with several of us. And so this is his backyard, and he was our tour guide through all these beautiful rides. Great pavement, no traffic. The traffic treats you well. They don't try to drive you off the road or insist on passing on bad situations. It's just fantastic riding.
Would you say Europeans are more forgiving of bicyclists?
I think it's true in Italy and in France that on these small mountain roads, they just wait until it's clear. Motorcycles, some of the kids on their Moto Guzzi, they go pretty fast. But most of the tourists in the Alps or the Pyrenees or in the Dolomites, they give you room.
If you were to visualize a map of France,
mm-hmm.
This is
in the southeast. This time we were in the southeast part. The Alps are between southeastern France and Italy and Switzerland, and we were near the Italian border. On one day we rode up a pass to the Italian border. We didn't go as far south as the Mediterranean. We didn't go as far west as the Rhone River. Our access point was Lyon, Lyon. That is a big airport, and so we fly there, and various ways we've done it, but we find a place where we can store the boxes that the bikes travel in, And then we make our trip, and at the end of the trip, we get back to the Lyon airport, turn in the van, have the bikes packaged up, and find our way home. We don't all travel together all the time, but in fact, sometimes I like taking part of the day and ride off by myself. I know what I'm doing, and I got the maps and know where I'm going, so we're fixed for flat tires and such.
And you're in the mood for yodeling.
Yeah, yeah.
How many people? There were four people in your party?
There were four people for two-thirds of the trip, we'd say, from Juneau, myself, and John Conley, and Greg Cook. And we're all, you know, past 60. And then the fourth one was Michel Krekelberg. We call him Krek, who lives in France. He's actually over 70, but it was still, at times, the strongest one. And then when we got to the Vercors, V-E-R-C-O-R-S, the Vercors area, three more Americans joined us. Jim Thompson, who's well known here from his work in the emergency room, and Jim Goot, who, well, used to live here, and then a friend of Jim's from Utah flew in. And so then we would travel with six or seven.
And I can just imagine it must have been fun.
It's fun.
Because you got to go up the mountain, but then you get to ride down.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, in the Vercors, well, almost every time we would end up going downhill. So you're not struggling riding uphill to get to the hotel. Yeah.
About how many kilometers?
50 to 100 maybe was the biggest day. And, you know, that's like going from the hospital to the end of the North Douglas Road and back, if you're just talking about mileage. But we did almost 9,000 feet one day, and it was hot. Every time I've been riding in France before, it was in, or Italy, it was in September, and it would cool off. This time it was over, in Fahrenheit, it was over 85 basically every day. And we learned a little bit about swarms of insects. It's, Alaska is not doesn't have a monopoly on that. But and they get you when you're going uphill and you're hot and sweaty.
You had Greg with you, but were there any language issues?
Well, I speak a little French. John Conley speaks a little French. And I find even a little makes it more fun. You just walk right into this restaurant and you stumble all over your French. As long as your manners are within their parameters, they don't expect you to speak good French. But and they nowadays, compared to, say, 20, 30 years ago, they'll switch to English cheerfully. But Greg, of course, speaks fantastic French and so skilled that some of those folks can't believe it. But it's mostly we did not have a language problem. The fellows who don't speak any English at all or any French at all have a little more trouble if they go by themselves. But we were usually in a group.
Any other issues popped up? Any time you said, I wish I would have remembered this?
Oh, no, I don't think. I mean, I've done this before. The others have done it before. We pretty much know where we're going and what we're up to. I did have a flat tire at speed going downhill and in the sidewall, and I patched the tire, and then I patched the wheel with a 50-euro note because they don't stretch. They protect the tire.
I've been talking with Eric Olson tonight at 5:15.
Tomorrow.
At 5:15, he'll be talking about his trip, bicycle ride with friends through the Alps of France. And that's happening at Cycle Alaska.
That's right.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask. Anything you'd like to add?
Oh, I hope everyone who's interested will show up. It'll be crowded, and that'll be good.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Jeff.
De verre, Je ne sais vibrer qu'en paratonnerre. Je suis condamnée à l'éclair, la poudre éphémère. Car si l'on m'aime, l'on doit me consumer. Mais demain, oui demain, j'en fais le serment. J'ouvrirai les yeux, mes deux yeux tout en grand, sur un bel homme, un bel amant, qui laissera ma vie sourde tout en m'aimant. Fibre de verre, je me suis cassé les dents, les nez sur bien des affaires. De cœur trop pincé, de mœurs trop épicées, car pour me plaire, l'on doit me consumer, mais demain, oui, demain, j'en fais le serment. J'ouvrirai les yeux, mes deux yeux tout en grand, sur toi, en somme, mon bel amant. Toi qui as si m'attend tout en m'aimant.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. Pick, click, give. A great and easy way to support nonprofits in Alaska. You simply donate during your PFD application process. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through March 31st. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
About 12 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our next guests in the studio are Eric Vang and Blake Ryder, here to talk about the Day of Service, which is coming up next Monday. Thanks for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
For people who don't know, can you please tell me what's happening on Monday?
So we're having our fifth annual this year. It's our Day of Service. It's basically our way of honoring some part of the memory of Martin Luther King is to help access to justice for folks who might otherwise not be able to talk to an attorney about their problem. So our sponsors are the State Bar Association. Blake was here from the Juno Bar Association. I'm from Legal Services. We sort of help with some structuring and organizing work. But basically the idea is that someone who has a question about a legal fraud or issue and doesn't know what to do next can come and actually talk to an attorney.
How much can they actually get answered?
It sort of depends upon the issue. They're not going to be actually, you know, representing the person from that issue forward. But our really hope is that someone can come in and say, hey, I've got this complex knot. And someone can help them sort of pick that knot apart and figure out where to start and who to talk to and what agency to deal with. So whether the problem is just a question of law or just bureaucracy, we should be able to help.
About how long should expect to stay there?
Most of our sessions for attorney usually will last about 15, 20 minutes, sometimes half an hour, depending upon the issue.
What are some common issues?
Common stuff we have coming up, people say, like, hey, how do I get a divorce? What's the difference between a divorce and a dissolution? Or I'm not sure what happened to my Medicaid benefits. Or what happened to my PFD when it was garnished? I have a problem with my landlord. Those are all things that ways that people commonly interact with the legal system. But at that point, usually it starts to get confusing, and sometimes people just stop paying attention.
This is happening next Monday. Can you tell me what time and where it's going to be happening?
Yeah, we got two different locations, actually. We're going to be in the Valley in the morning and downtown in the afternoon. I'll talk about the Valley quick and kick it over to Blake for the afternoon session. In the morning, we're going to be at the new Alaska Legal Services office in the Jordan Creek Center. We're at 8800 Glacier Highway. We're at room 228, sort of upstairs from the main entrance. We've been downtown for like 30 years, and we just moved out to the Valley, so it's a good chance for people to stop by and figure out where we are if you need help. And then in the afternoon, we're going to be downtown at the courthouse.
Yeah, so there'll be an afternoon session at the courthouse, 1 to 4 p.m., and again, there's going to be lawyers and non-lawyer volunteers, but I'm with the Juno Bar Association. We're looking for actual more volunteers, so if you're a lawyer and you're listening to this, please give us a call or email the Juno Bar Association at gmail.com. We really need your help for this, and afternoon session is going to be the same as the morning session, but just different location. And I'm going to be in charge of bringing refreshments. So there'll be coffee and things to eat. So come on down.
Now you're doing it because it's Martin Luther King Day and people are off of work, so they can normally come down and help out.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. So it's good.
And the court system is really helpful with that. One of the reasons we can use the courthouse is because it's MLK Day and court's not in session. So the court system is very kind enough to let us use the building and open up the doors and let us use the space, which is really wonderful.
But how many lawyers are taking part?
In past years, we've had 20, we've had 30, depending upon the circumstances. So we're hoping to match that again. So our goal is that if someone shows up, we can get them in and out and talk to somebody as quickly and easily as possible.
What should people bring?
Mostly, if you're bringing in for a specific legal issue, if you ever received any notices or mailings about that issue, that could really help us pin down what's going on. If that's a notice from a landlord or a debt collector or something from the government, whatever it is, any actual documentation you may have about that issue, preferably not a shoebox, but a couple pieces of paper could really help us figure out what's going on.
Have you been to one before?
Yes, I've been to the last quite a few of them. We've had fairly good turnouts. We had a couple where we had a big dump of snow, which didn't really help people getting out and getting to us. But we're hoping the weather will be nicer on Monday.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be a problem.
All right. So, I mean, people need more information. Is there a phone number they can call or a website you can direct them to?
For website wise, you can go to Alaska Bar. ALASKABAR.org/MLK, which has got some of the information for you there. Also, feel free to call the Alaska Legal Services Office, 586-6425. We'll get you more information, let you know what's going on, and hopefully get you out. We'd love to see folks.
All right, thanks for coming down.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Support for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
Do you enjoy folk music? Looking for something fun to do on a Wednesday night? Then tune in to Friends and Neighbors, 7 to 9 p.m. on KRNN 102.7. Hi, this is Mike Sicarius, host of Friends and Neighbors. Together we'll explore and enjoy the breadth of folk music, from blues to ballads to banjos and much more. So kick back and relax this Wednesday evening with Friends and Neighbors, 7 to 9 p.m. on KRNN 102.7.
Just about ready to the top of the hour. Tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, June Pardis will be our host. She'll talk with Greg Cheney about accessory apartment grants. We'll learn about Alaska Beer Week. We'll also get a preview of the new play at Perseverance Theater. Our voices will be heard. And Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Hub. Tonight on KTOB or KRNN, stormy weather with Katie B. She's going to be featuring music of David Bowie. It's happening from 9 to 11 p.m. on KRNN FM 102.7. Weather forecast for tonight: rain showers with patchy fog. For tomorrow, patchy fog in the morning, then rain showers in the afternoon.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at